back with another edition of The Exchange. I'm joined via teleconference with my co-host, Blake Doyle. It's been a pretty interesting past couple of days in terms of what's going on in relation to government funding to kind of lessen the impacts of COVID-19. And everyone's still trying to get through it, but here we are. Positive attitudes. I'm sure you're pretty positive cooped up at your house, Blake.
Yeah, it's funny. You always, for a dozen of these, you've always asked, how are things this week? And every week the conversation is kind of the same. I start off fairly optimistic, and I still see glimmers of optimism for when we come out of this. In general, I'm disappointed with some of the approaches. I think we've lacked a little bit of leadership, but it's a tough time. Businesses are having a tough time and they're looking for some guidance. But do I feel optimistic? I feel optimistic measured by quarters. So two quarters out, I feel there's some light today. It's a tough time to be in business.
Yeah, exactly. And especially, I think everyone's getting to the point where 2 weeks into it'd be 3 weeks into our kind of self-isolation that everyone's been kind of forced into. And I think people are kind of, you can tell, are getting a little bit more stir crazy and think like they want to get things done, especially with tourism season on the way. So golf course operators, restaurateurs are like thinking, well, how is this going to work? What am I going to do? So I think there's a little bit of anxiety and worry in that sense, but I think everyone's kind of on the same page as like, until we kind of get this figured out, we're forced to stay home and forced to kind of put up with it for the time being.
Yeah, it's a tough situation to have this forced quarantine. Now, we may be better than some places. There's other countries. India, for instance, have a pretty dramatic quarantine. Nova Scotia has a strong quarantine. But then there's communities like Austria and Sweden that are opening up their markets. So yeah, there's a real mix of approaches, and as a case study in retrospect, it'd be easy and interesting to look back and say, okay, did New York do the right thing? Today you'd argue they certainly haven't. And who prevailed? And that's one of the things we looked at in this week's Business Edge was, how do you position, how can Prince Edward Island prosper, and do we have any unique attributes that we could leverage?
Right. So I guess just to touch on that, you mentioned you were in the Guardian this past weekend. And has there been much feedback based on your article?
There's always feedback. It's ones that are controversial that I kind of like the most. This one, I get a lot of direct texts and emails and conversations. People are reading the Guardian, and that's great news for the Guardian and Saltwire. And people have thoughts on what I'm sort of communicating. But I think that's what we need. We need people to present concepts through some medium. I know the provincial government has set up this little website where you can throw suggestions in. I think at this point, they clearly haven't gotten very many good suggestions based on the policies they're rolling out. But I think there's an opportunity for people to present ideas that can be challenged and tweaked a bit, and then maybe implemented. And that's an approach, I guess, we've taken in looking at how PEI as a microeconomy or as a microcosm, how can we position, manage our own internal economy and, circulate the capital that we have, both from provincial government employees who are still functioning, and try to get some service sectors open again. So can we get the restaurants active? Can we manage our borders to try to keep community transmission to a minimum so that the economy can resume? And that won't happen in 2 weeks' time, but it could happen within 4 weeks if there's some direction provided.
Yeah, and Minister McKay announced, I think on his Facebook maybe last night, just saying that like for the tourism and seasonal operators, there will be kind of announcements coming up. Maybe those came from the suggestion box that you were talking about, but it's hard to really say what will come from that. And I think what I've noticed from this kind of forced isolation, I shouldn't say forced, we're not in jail, but it's nice to you have to stay home, is that everyone has more time to kind of self-reflect and think about, okay, what am I going to do in 6 months from now? What am I going to do? It's kind of like just not that everyone has the time to think about that kind of thing, but at this personally, I've had a couple hours a day just to kind of think on and ponder on what might the future hold and what I can do now to better position myself for the next 6 months kind of thing. So that's one positive I've seen out of this is kind of the ability to self-reflect and maybe do a little more reading, a little more writing to kind of position yourself better down the road.
Yeah, I know in your case, it's probably between 6 and 8 p.m. because you're so busy with operations to the balance of the day. And I think the other thing is family connections. Like there is an element of too much close proximity. But I think, in my case, it's been a great opportunity to have more time and more uninterrupted time in some respects to spend with family. I think kids and family in general probably are benefiting from that.
A
but
reset,
we do have to
so
get a reset, but the economy is a priority. This situation is a biologic issue. It's now manifested itself into a financial crisis, and there's only one way to solve this financial crisis. It's got to be government leadership. You mentioned about Minister McKay making some announcements. That's great. We've seen a lot of announcements, but I haven't seen a real coherent strategy in how these are being implemented. So you almost seem knee-jerk reacting to maybe it's the inbox that comes in, maybe it's constituent demands. But I think what I need to see, I think what the business community needs to see, is that there is a path. We know that there's light at the end of the tunnel. We have an agenda to get there. And the programs that have been announced haven't just been haphazard. They're actually part of a strategy to implement a solution out of this. And I think that's absent. And I think if there are more announcements made, it's got to be part of a coherent approach. So the business has confidence that there's a manageable way out of this. I think the implementation path is probably stressing the bureaucracy, and it's challenging government, and it's frustrating the community as we're looking for ways to stimulate and support business resumption. There will be substantial business collapse through this, and that's already started. There'll be people that just want to survive, and that's unfortunately a natural outcome of this. So those that are wanting to be part of it, you've got to preserve, protect your assets, and then figure out a way to emerge from this.
Exactly. And I think a lot of that will revolve on good policy, policy to like in the immediate future, but also policy to kind of down the road to make sure we can sustain all these announcements being rolled out. So that's kind of a good segue to mention of our guest today. We recorded this a couple weeks ago. Jeff Collins is a trade and policy advisor with the province PEI. He's also a professor at UPEI, amongst a lot of other things. He's a pretty well-accomplished guy. Both you and I, Blake, know him through different paths, but he's a well-rounded individual and a very bright person as well.
Well, when you look at policy and the people within government that hopefully are helping to influence policy direction, it's people like Jeff that I have confidence in. They've got both the aptitude but the grounding to present well-conceived, rational approaches to the challenge that we're in. And one of the things Jeff will talk about is, maybe this is the opportunity. We set up our own space force on PEI and have a defense zone around our perimeters of our border to keep COVID out. That wasn't part of the conversation when we had it, but anyway, I'm being a little bit facetious, but I think that these are the kind of people, and it's great to have Jeff on as a policy advocate, because we need the brightest people that the province have access to help navigate their way through. And I hope, Jeff and many other people like him are presenting their concepts to government.
Yeah, I think his role will be more important now than ever, because in the trade and economic portfolio, like that's what's going to keep PEI afloat whenever this kind of does spin back around. Like you said, it's important to have the brightest individuals, regardless of whether there's political stripe or whatever the case may be. But Jeff certainly is that person. And when the first 2 minutes of talking to him, you'll realize how bright he is, and like his years of schooling have done for him.
Well, there's no political stripes. This is just collaboration. I mean, everybody's this homogenous sort of, purple color, I guess, of all the parties coming together. Be interesting to see if and when they get back to the legislature, how the parties feel about the collaboration. And if they've been involved, I think government certainly needs to get a lot of voices to come up with strategies, and hopefully they're doing that. But yeah, having guys like Jeff at a policy think tank level, it gives me reassurance that the government's on the right track.
Yeah, and just to touch on before we put the interview over, with that, in terms of the legislature, they were talking about doing, I think you need a minimum of 10 MLAs in the House to kind of pass legislation. So that would be five from the government, likely, and four from the opposing parties, including the Speaker, I guess. So it would require collaboration, but also the idea that we could have 10 MLAs in there, socially distanced, I guess 6 feet apart, to kind of pass essential legislation to kind of govern the next, however long this will last.
Well, that's interesting, because there is $40 million in special warrants just been confirmed, I think, late last week to help navigate. Now, and frankly, it'll be three or four times that over the next couple of quarters, I think, once the government sort of recognize what they've got to use to stimulate. And unless you're the Galactic Empire, you kind of need that oversight of the legislature to kind of approve and validate some of these spending. And you do need to spend your way out of this. Business cannot... they can't, in my opinion, they're not equipped to address this state sanctions shut down, and this is at state from a very broad level. All governments have suspended the economy. They're going to be the ones that have to kickstart it back up. So getting the legislature is probably important to look at some of this spending and to test whether or not it's been invested in the right ways.
Definitely. So that'll be interesting to see, especially as like we haven't really developed any new cases over the past couple of days, but there's bound to be more. And we can't get too excited yet, I guess, that, oh, it's almost over. No, it's, if you look to our counterparts in even Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, there's a lot more cases in their daily, up in the double digits daily. So I don't think it's not going to disappear like that. But we'll keep the positivity and everyone can remain at home.
That's right. And we won't let Carol Baskin run our political provincial strategy.
We'll lock her up.
With lots of good pop culture out there.
Yeah, there's no shortage of entertainment, including The Exchange, presented by Confederation Group, of course. Anyways, we will now turn it over to our interview with Jeff Collins. We kind of go through what he does. There's a long list of what he has done or what he will be doing in the future. So that's a good point to a good segue into our interview with Jeff. Today we have a pretty popular fellow within the province of PEI, Jeff Collins. He works for both the province of PEI and at the University of PEI. So he's very cross-cultured in what his backgrounds are. And today we're lucky to have him on The Exchange. Welcome, Jeff.
Happy to be here. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Jeff's got a pretty broad background, and there's while we're an island, independent, isolated in the Gulf, we're actually probably not an island geopolitically.
Right.
You've done a lot of research on that. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and then we'll get into you know, what's happening trade-wise, how is BI positioned, what challenges might we want to be considering, because there's lots of things that people don't normally touch on.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me here. I'm an islander by choice. I'm actually originally from another island, from Newfoundland, a little town called Placentia. And I moved to PEI in 2014. My spouse, she's originally from the island, and we had been living in Ottawa at the time, and we were looking to get back in the East Coast and for career opportunities. It worked out, of course, it worked out for me, but I was definitely more flexible because I was still doing my PhD. So, and you know, I was teaching part-time at UPI when I got here. I was doing research contracts on the side. So those first few years living on the island were just a chance for me to network and explore and get involved and get familiar with things here. My research areas are kind of eclectic, but if you could like sum it up, it would be Canadian defense policy and Canadian foreign policy. So I'm very interested in this country's role around the world, how it is involved in international institutions like the North Atlantic Treaty Organization or the United Nations, how we balance competing interests from close allies like the United States, who is, of course, our major trading partner, but significantly is our major national security ally. We're also at the same time trying to get involved economically and politically in different parts of the world where we've historically not been involved very much, like East Asia. So those are kind of like the intersection of my interests, and I've been very fortunate that I've managed to secure a number of teaching opportunities, as I know before, UPI, but most recently I teach in this quite innovative master's program called Master in Global Affairs. So it's a joint program between UPI and the university in Spain, and I teach a course on international organizations and security, and I teach students at the graduate level really how to understand the design of institutions created after the Second World War, like the UN or the World Trade Organization or the World Bank. How have they changed over time, and do they have the ability to sustain the challenges that have been thrown at them? To get them thinking about, you know, not everything is permanent, and maybe we need to look at redesigning how we operate in the world and how we do relations internationally.
Oh, so this is a great example, Sam, of another exceptionally qualified person. Could probably live anywhere in the world, both you and your wife.
Yeah.
You've chosen to be in PEI and make a contribution.
I guess you probably had a little bit of a maritime feel coming from Newfoundland. Like, there'd be similarities, but obviously differences as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, just looking off, I have your resume or your CV pulled up. It's thicker than the Charlottetown phone book, I think, in terms of what you've done in your past.
So you got your political science and history degrees from the Memorial.
That's right.
So did you live close to St. John's, or did
we? No. Well, I mean, relative. Newfoundland, much bigger island. Placentia is 90 minutes from St. John's, so that's close.
Yeah, I guess I'm
here at PEI, that's like, you know, the boonies, yeah. Right? Where you need to fly in. I'm a Bayman. I'm from.
Yep, you're a Bayman from Newfoundland. You did your BA at Memorial, and then you decided that was enough. Let's go to law school. So yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about
that? Yeah. I was very interested in international law. I did a course in political science. They sometimes, like here at UPI, they bring in lawyers to teach courses in the political science department, and I was just smitten by it. We had a couple of guys come in and teach us international maritime law, and another guy to teach us international public law. And so that got me fascinated. These individuals are both practitioners. They're not in academia, but they have academic backgrounds. I was like, this is kind of cool. And I like how they were taking something that's kind of academic-ish in a way, which public international law can be, and yet making it relevant to how we understand policies, and especially on the East Coast, if you're talking about, you know, especially maritime law, how it influences like fishing boundaries and control over like oil and gas resources. Like, wow, that felt really close to home. It's not abstract anymore. And so that got me thinking about what could I do that didn't involve the practice is a law in the sense of being a member of a bar, but actually the academic pursuit of law. And so the University of Aberdeen struck out to me because it was a very international legal focused university, and it was in Scotland, which was really cool. But the focus on the international law part was clear. It's a 500 plus year old university. They've been teaching law for over 500 years. And so going to like having classes in 400 year old buildings, talking by scholars, some of whom have gone to the European Court of Human Rights, and others that advise the UK military, and they're telling you, oh, this is how the law functions in practice. It was fascinating. It was a real treat to live there, and I managed to do a degree in a couple of years, and I didn't finish with the UK. As I came back and worked in Newfoundland, and just doing contract work, doing some work for my family in construction, and then I thought, you know what, my wife at the time was like, she's like, I'd like to do a graduate degree in the UK too. And so she got into a university in UK. And I thought, well, I'd like to carry on this interest of law intersecting with politics and policy. And so I found a master's program at the University of Birmingham. So I went back to the UK and lived there again and did a 1 year master's in international relations.
So you had the biggest, in Birmingham, just outside London, it's a giant city by relative
strength. Yeah, like 4 million in the greater population. Yeah.
So you still had to lure to get back to the East Coast.
Yeah.
Back to this scale of environment.
Yes.
Some of your research, I guess, Sam, you've got anything there from Jeff's background, but certainly on trade policy, which is what you focus a lot on today.
That's what my job. Yeah. Yep.
So what's happening? You know, we've got a fairly an ally who may or may not be as strong an ally.
Mm-hmm.
Both of us. How do you see the province responding to some of these geopolitical changes, mm-hmm. primarily with their largest trading partner? Are we exposed? You know, PEI depends less so maybe than other provinces, but mm-hmm. we're still pretty dependent on the U.S.
Yeah, but we're a very trade-dependent province in the country anyway, arguably probably the most trade-dependent. And I mean that in the sense of so much of our GDP depends on exports of goods and services, not just to other countries, but even with internally.
Yeah.
So it does mean we're more susceptible to the to and fro that happens even within Canada on trade issues, but also internationally. So I think for us the big challenge is, and of course this is my opinion, is the need to not just focus what goes on in national capitals and what's said on the news headlines. Well, that's always important because that shapes a context. But, you know, our trading partners are massive. Like, they simply say, well, we should trade with the EU. Okay, what does that mean? Now it's down to 27 countries, but it's still...
and diminishing probably at the moment. You know?
Yeah, it's still 450 million people. It's still, depending on the factor of the UK, you know, $12 trillion GDP. Like, it is a massive... economic and political entity of 27 constituent countries speaking multiple languages. They have regions within themselves that have different It could be primary industries or tertiary industries. So I guess the argument I was saying, and I indicated this before on CBC last month, when I did an interview with them, is you really need to dig deep into the country you're interested in, or just if you have a certain product or service and understand what's going out there. You know, when I was in the U.S. last fall, with the U.S. State Department brought me down, a view-based trade relationships discussions based on what you heard in Washington, you would think that, yeah, there's probably not much opportunity here. It seems total gridlock. But if you left Washington and went to the state level and spoke to state government people and state businesses, no, they're fully on board. They want to trade. They want to do business. So it's that need to willingness to go beyond and do your homework and
not just read the newspaper.
Yeah, exactly. So it requires a lot of really social science 101, like learn about the place you want to go to and figure out what's going on down there. You know, we're pretty lucky here on the island the last few years. You guys know more than I do just how more cosmopolitan the province has become, how more international focused is. We have a lot of human capital here of people from all over the world who understand where they're from. And sometimes I wonder if we're not, use is probably not the best word, but for lack of a better word, I mean, use the talents we have here to understand what's going on back in their home countries.
I would say exclusively, we're probably not. Mm-hmm. I mean, even your background in the UK, have you ever been tapped to sort of open up dialogue or connections?
Never. I think I have like friends and business and UK government all over the place.
Right? So an untapped opportunity.
Yeah.
And untapped by the local business sector, probably untapped by government. So you mentioned the U.S. is our state, so a big part of our GDP has been export. We've had some really strong sectors.
Yeah.
Aerospace, probably number one.
I'd have to go back and check, but
there's some big contributors.
Yeah, lobster's still pretty big, too, into the U.S., for sure.
And if you were a small business, are there states that you think are more amenable to working with PEI versus...
That's a good question. That's something I think requires deep digging. My experience dealing with briefly Nebraska officials, but clearly yes. You think of different tax regimes, perhaps more competitively. There's 50 states competing against each other for business, so it's just a more dynamic environment by default. Yeah. You know, and so the other thing is, you know, their institutions in terms of post-secondary. Ours are really good. We have a really good international reputation, but their ability to like build up alumni and utilize the university alumni, it's deeply impressive. You go to a city like Lincoln, which probably with the population of Moncton, New Brunswick. Now, the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, has a 90,000-seat stadium there for football. And they bring people from all over the world to study and research there. It's well-funded. They have a powerful alumni network. And you can just see that, like,
Branching out,
crossing business and political life, and sometimes you wonder, maybe I know I don't know enough about university alumni here in Canada. There's specific funds, but it strikes me as they're way ahead of the game, right?
And it's a bigger, probably more tightly knit, especially in football.
Yeah,
I mean that's a great motivator. I think there's companies like iWave, they're starting to tap into some of those.
But that's still a lot of the, like, for example, iWave, their focus is more on the U.S. Like, if you look at their client list, it's 90% U.S. because they want to tap into that alumnus kind of background that say, okay, this guy's a multimillionaire, this guy owns this company. Why aren't we tapping into this?
Yeah.
I think in Canada we could start to do that, even PEI as a leader. But
I think EPI is getting
they're
better.
They're starting, definitely in bed. Like, there's a whole department committed to that. But it's just how do we branch out and kind of tap into that even further?
And it's those informal networks and the connections and the friendships. And so U.S., my experience, it's a much more aggressive culture. People want to do business, want to do it faster.
Yeah.
We probably don't get into this too much, but from your research, can we as a culture adapt to that hungrier market? So there's lots of good business people, but the culture is quite different between the U.S. and the
U.S. It is. It's a more individualistic ethos, and that's just rooted into the fabric of their society over centuries. So is that something that's exportable? I don't know. I think it's a good question, actually. Something you certainly chew on in terms of you get into discussions on tax regimes in Canada, but I think it's more than tax regimes. Like, it's a literal
cultural
thing. And Canada, you know, there's pros and cons of all of it. Like, we're a much more communitarian society.
Yeah.
And there are benefits to that for sure. But, you know, sometimes I think when we think about comparing ourselves as a province in terms of where we are as a place to do business, we often just look at the other Atlantic provinces. Mm-hmm. We like forget New England.
Right.
Which, you know,
Massachusetts is a giant market.
Yeah. I mean, their intellectual capital down there, okay. I mean, the MIT and Harvard, and that alone dwarfs it. Cambridge is a magnet for ICTs, right?
Yeah.
And so, and venture capitalism, right? Yeah, you can drive there in a day. And so sometimes I think the discussions need to be less about, well, let's, you know, harmonize taxes or harmonize policies within Atlantic Canada. That's great, but we have this behemoth that's like a day's drive away.
It's closer than a lot of provinces.
It's closer to us than
it's like, a bigger market.
Quebec.
Exactly. Yeah, I can drive to Boston faster than I can drive to Toronto.
Right.
Do we have these type of conversations? It seems like being more on a business level, like with certain companies there, or, you know, that then you hear about it, but like in terms of like an export strategy or in a foreign direct investment strategy, I don't really hear about it.
So it's funny. I think for the seafood sector, I mean, there's big participation in seafood
and
expos.
Boston seafood.
It's a big element. Yeah. But I lived in Halifax for 10 years, and I think the economic development department of that community, that province, was much more aggressive up and down for venture capital conversations. I think there's a closer connection. Just from historical reasons.
Yeah, they have historical cultural ties for sure.
Yeah.
But so do we.
We do too.
Yeah, yeah.
But even with the Halifax explosion, there's a connection there that we probably lack.
And the Christmas tree donation they give. Like little things that are symbolic, but yet mean a lot.
And there's the people in Boston recognize that contribution.
Right.
So, you know, PEI is an island.
Mm-hmm.
You've done research in defense policy.
Yep.
Do we need to have our own defense department here for you guys?
We need a defense regime.
Right. We need to keep all you non-islanders away.
Dynamite the bridge and seal it off. You know, in the U.S., a number of states actually have departments of military departments, but they're dedicated to overseeing their national guards.
Yes.
It's a very different framework, and emergency management.
Okay.
So, but that's probably the answer you're looking for.
I think it's poking
We need a shipbuilding policy.
Yeah.
Well,
so, you know, and that island sort of conversation, you did a fair bit of research on Australia as another island.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Independent, isolated.
Yeah.
We're not quite as isolated, but we are independent. Any similarities between kind of the challenges that they're going through as a sovereign state and what we're going through as a somewhat sovereign province, I guess?
I think we're encountering today the challenges the Australians have been dealing with for the past decade or so, which is they are stuck, not geographically, but politically and economically and militarily between two superpowers.
Right.
Back in the 1960s, up to the 1960s, Australia depended on the United Kingdom for defense and security, then transitioned to the United States, and then the United States retreated post-Vietnam War. That was a real rupture in foreign policy thinking in Australia. They began to think, well, you know, the United States will still be a major ally. We have a treaty with them, but clearly the United States can turn inwards depending on the administration of the day and how dependable are they at the end of the day.
Yes.
So the Australians have really done two prongs. One, they've invested a lot more money into their armed forces than we have.
Yep.
They want to have an independent, light military capability. The second thing is they've spent a lot of effort diversifying markets throughout Southeast Asia and getting involved in political and military institutions in Southeast Asia where we sometimes just show up. But obviously, you know, they are closer in some ways, but others have pointed out that the flight difference between like Canberra and Beijing is about the same as Vancouver to Beijing.
Okay.
So it's not total geographic, it's just a realization that we are our own country. We need to do some form of policy approaches that reflect that we can't depend on anyone. At the same time, today, as you and I discussed before we started doing this interview, there are the huge debates in Australia right now, not including the forest fires, of course, is the role of Chinese investment by state-owned enterprises into their economy. Should massive natural gas, iron ore, and nickel zinc deposits, whatever, be under a regional competitor,
right?
Who does see the world in less silos and more in terms of economics and security are linked
over a long period of time.
Over a long period of time for the long game.
So we're not, Canada's not really that different in some respects. Mm-hmm. So we do have some legislation that protects some national interests.
Yes.
But in the last 10 years, we've seen a lot of probably strategic national interests, both in, you know, intellectual capital, but also physical resource, be sold to external
interests. Yeah. You remember CNOOC and Nexen a few years ago, the Nexen deal, Chinese national.
For the oil?
Yeah, it was probably about a decade ago, and it led to this major debate in Ottawa.
Right.
Like I was in grade 7 at the time, so I wouldn't have been, I would have been too involved.
But then they were willing to put serious coin down for this company, and, you know, at the same time, they were getting a significant stake in the oil and gas sector in Canada.
And should government be interfering in
that? Right, yeah, and it was a conservative government at the time, which is a very odd position they found themselves in, you know. Private enterprise should be private enterprise, but that's a state-owned company.
And there's some strategic interest in that asset.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's a tentacle of the arm of the state it comes from. It's not simply this independent company with shareholders.
Right. So, I mean, and do you see concern? Is there case studies where these policies have led to loss of control of natural resources? Is that a...
I don't think... Nothing really in like the modern sense. You know, you have the... Lots of history on colonialism and companies coming in, like the British East India Company and what have you. But in a modern sense, I think we're still trying to grapple with just a state. What is a state-owned enterprise? You know, from a Canadian perspective, we call them Crown Corps. You know, they're involved in hydro, like Hydro-Québec, or even on a more smaller scale. We have nothing quite comparable to what a number of countries, and not just China. You look at Russia, you can look at Malaysia. A number of them where these entities are not just major private sector players, but they're actually forming or part of a larger foreign policy discussion.
Right.
We have no real parallel to kind of compare that to understand it, and I think we're playing catch up.
Yeah,
for sure.
Things are moving quickly.
Yeah.
What about tying into that Huawei?
Yeah.
So that's a complicated file because of extradition treaties and trading partner considerations. You know, even the need to have accessible fifth generation communications.
Yeah.
Have you done any look at
that? I'm not an ICT person, so I can't really comment on the merits of, you know, their 5G approach, but I kind of see it from like a geopolitical perspective, is that sure, you know, Huawei spokespersons, they'll insist that they're an independent private sector company, but we're in this, look where we are right now. We've followed an extradition treaty.
Yep. Agreement.
With our major military and economic partner, and our number two economic partner essentially punishing us for honoring that treaty.
Right.
Right. And at the same time, Huawei's insisting, well, we're a private company. Well, world superpowers acting on your behalf. let's not pretend this is not happening, right? Like, there's clearly some connection. It's no surprise that some senior officials in Beijing view Huawei as a crown jewel of what the new China represents on the global stage, and are willing to clearly do anything to protect it.
So would Bombardier be a different scenario from a Canadian perspective? It's a private company.
Mm-hmm.
There's national interest involved. Mm-hmm. There's maybe trade protection issues. Yeah. Is Huawei different than maybe a Canadian?
I think so, in the sense that, you know, my understanding of Bombardier or even SNC-Lavalin is more about protecting domestic jobs, which is kind of a long-standing umbrella that numerous governments in this country have long done. The difference with Huawei and how the Chinese state has reacted is it seems to be viewing any restriction of that company as an attack on the Chinese state itself.
Right.
And is willing to use whatever
levers
it can. Like, the idea that a Canadian government would detain the foreign nationals of another country over a dispute involving the leader of a private company, it seems unfathomable. I suspect would never hold up as a court challenge in this country, but... It seems like we're finally experiencing what I think other countries have experienced, which is that intersection of security and economics. Mm-hmm. You know, our approach to East Asia, and I would argue probably foreign policy generally since the 1960s in this country, has been to take a silo approach. You know, so much of the world sees security and economics connected, but we've been like, well, hypothetical, let's go to ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Nations. We like to enter trade discussions with you and improve our trade relations. Their response would be, well, you guys don't show up militarily. That country to our north is a regional competitor and threat to us. Right. And you guys, it's more than just trading with us. You need to actually show up and be involved. Yeah. And so Australia can demonstrate that. They've invested in their naval capabilities and continues to invest in their military naval capabilities and do take part in, you know, military fora related to those countries. We sometimes show up, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we send a ship every few years for a tour. Like, we're just not consistent. We talk a good game. Not talking about it's no government specific. It's just over time. We talk a good game about wanting to be involved in different parts of the world, but the follow through is just never there, right? And it's like the last few years have gotten me to really think about, okay, what do we kind of need to do? You're certainly seeing the last 2 years. The current federal government has been sending ships and planes regularly now throughout parts of East Asia. That's good. That's good because, like, that's kind of showing support. And then and one of the big issues over there is navigation of the seas.
Right.
The Chinese claim
everything
is essentially a lake, and their neighbors have issues with that.
Sure.
And so one of the things that we get back to international maritime law, we talked at the beginning, is to demonstrate freedom of navigation, right? And so our ability to actually participate in those type of missions is really crucial, I think, to winning over support for improved trade relationships.
So you mentioned there's military blocks, there's trading blocks.
Yeah.
Some of them, like NATO, is probably under the current administration, maybe so at the border, there's some friction, I think, within NATO.
Yeah.
So how are these trading blocks and military blocks intersecting? And what's going to win in this kind of environment? Is it going to be military or is it going to be trade?
I think the fascinating thing in that's happening today, unlike, say, I'll backtrack. What we're going through today is something we haven't experienced really since the 1930s, which is great power rivalry. After the end of the Second World War in 1945, we had two superpowers that largely could influence different spheres of the world. And while there were certainly conflicts that emerged over time, there was a degree of stability there. What we've got now is really a multipolar world, a world where rising powers, India, Brazil, for example, which have both very nationalistic governments now, and certainly see themselves as not just military players, but also major economic players. Mm-hmm. And then now we have really an arguable return to a superpower dynamic mixed with rising powers who also want to do their own thing. Like, we have to really go back to the 1930s to understand what that dynamic looked like. In the 1930s, it was incredibly unstable. Mm-hmm. It led to arms races, protectionism, and eventually a breakout of the Second World War. Those were some factors. But today, I think is less about the use of military force between these countries and more of economics. I've been really struck by the weaponization of trade and economics, and especially of state-owned enterprises in pursuing foreign policy goals around the world. I think of Russia, which is a massive natural gas supplier to Central and Eastern Europe. Its willingness to use even private companies, of course, there's a blurring of private and public in Russia as well, to essentially threaten foreign governments that they'll shut off gas supplies in the dead of winter unless they came into their demands. Like, that is a weaponization.
Right.
Though it's probably costing them money to do so, it's worth the price if it achieves another foreign policy goal.
Yeah.
And you've seen that with China as well. Its massive amount of wealth has been channeled into the Road and Belt Initiative, building public infrastructure, ports, railways, whatever, all needed in parts of the world, but serving that country's foreign policy goals.
Export.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. And also serving military functions. They're not building ports for container ships, but also for warships.
Right.
Right. So you're seeing this kind of spread up around the world.
So weaponization of economics, you see that, I think, you could probably make an argument you see between China and U.S. as well.
So, absolutely.
How you see that playing out? I mean, I'm not close to it, but there's an argument that the U.S. are hurting themselves, mm-hmm. that they can withstand the pain mm-hmm. better than China can. And China now have some other challenges with the coronavirus.
A lot of internal problems, too. I'm certainly not a Chinese expert, but you follow the news, you know there are ethnic minority treatments and resentment there. There's a classism, a massive economic divide, and so they have a lot of internal social problems as well. But the ability of the state, though, since 1949 to maintain a tight grip on things is quite remarkable. So it's always this debate with China observers is, when will the Chinese Communist Party lose its grip, or has it found its ability, a means in which to maintain authority? And what does that mean? It goes back to the Soviet Union question. We all could have seen the Soviet Union collapsing at some day, but no one knew when it happened. It then happened on Christmas Day, 1991.
Right.
And we're like, so I guess the Cold War is over.
Right.
This country just dissolved, yeah. Right? China's leaders, particularly the current regime, have paid a particular attention to the lessons of the Soviet Union and what they need to do. Grant economic liberalization, but maintain tight political control. And that formula still seems to work for them. For the United States and China, I think it's one of those questions that kind of makes me a little nervous is you weaponize trade and economics, but at what point does that cross over the military?
You put enough pressure, somebody's going to have to
change. Right. And the arteries of business in the world today are not just the internet through digital, but also seaways. It's like the ancient, it's an ancient lesson that he who controls the oceans can control the world. And so right now the power of the United States Navy has really, since the end of the Second World War, been this kind of talked about story of keeping the ocean pathways open so that global trade and commerce can move, right?
Yeah.
And so you're seeing that the not just China, but Russia as well, are investing massive sums of money into naval capabilities, particularly submarines. There is a submarine arms race throughout East Asia, and they are investing in this technology like you wouldn't believe. And so the idea is you can use submarines to shut down choke points like the Malacca Straits, Strait of Hormuz, all these areas that are major conduits for global commerce. And what does that mean, right? So we haven't really... that hasn't happened yet, but the fact that they're investing in this type of technology, not just China, but other countries, it tells you how they see the geopolitical chessboard.
Right.
Again, economics and security mix.
Yeah.
So for the United States, I don't know if President Trump has a coherent plan, but he certainly has the assets in which to act out the United States military is unparalleled in rivalry. Its economy still is more dynamic and robust than any in the world. And so it has those two things in its favor.
Is there a compulsion to strike first?
Yeah, that's always a perennial debate in strategic studies, is like the option of first strike or deterrence, right? What do you need to do?
Yeah.
And we're only now starting to have these discussions publicly. I know there are always academics who talk about it, or at least publicly. Okay, what does this mean in terms of international security and stability? But what does this mean for Canada? China's the number two trading partner. The United States is the number one. They're also our number one military ally. So, but at the same time, as the Huawei thing has shown, they're willing, at least the current administration, is willing to put their close ally in a very awkward position without really consideration. And the whole discussion over NATO has been the same type of example of that.
It's interesting that I wasn't aware of the military buildup, at least
submarines for sure.
Yeah, that's an interesting kind of unknown to me, at least.
Australia's building 12.
12 right now?
Yeah.
Nuclear power, probably?
No, right? Diesel. They bought a French design and they're
removing
the nuclear power.
It's a fun fact.
Yeah, it's at least $50 billion.
So that's a good segue into the shipbuilding contract that we have in our region.
Yeah.
Touted as a tremendous economic boom for the region, a great opportunity probably to unlock the potential of the Georgetown shipyard as an example, and have Islanders participate and benefit in that. Has it achieved its objective? Have the regional maritime provinces benefited from this investment? Could we be doing more, or is this province positioned well to?
I think it's an understanding what does a modern naval frigate look like, or surface command, to use the Navy's term. So there's a number of projects that went to Irving, two big ones. One was Arctic offshore patrol ships, They're under construction right now, but the big one is for 15 surface combatants.
And this is a 30-year kind of...
Oh, it's going to be longer than that.
Is it? Okay.
That's right now, the price tag on the surface combatants is about $60 billion.
Holy.
It's the largest government project ever undertaken in this country's history. By
so if you were Sam's age, would you be trying to figure out how to get a hook your wagon to that?
Yeah, train? Absolutely. Absolutely. Be I'm a welder. In, They're paying good for welders.
Going into building boats. Well, Blake has a boat, so maybe he could add it to the repertoire.
We could put it in the Navy. Yeah. It could be part of the Naval Defense for PEI.
Here we go.
Back to that. So what does PEI need to do? What do we need to do to take better advantage of this opportunity at our shores?
Understand the supply chain dynamics. A modern warship today is less about the hull. And usually when people talk shipbuilding, they talk about, well, how do we take advantage of hull construction?
Right.
That's important. But that hull construction is less than 50% of the ship.
Right.
The rest is weapon systems, communications, safety systems, survival systems. Like it's all the technology that's needed to make this vessel work. And if you go online, I believe Irving Shipbuilding has a webpage where you can look at the supply chain opportunities. The federal government does as well under PSPC. But those would be the first places to look to see what possibilities are there. I suspect 30-plus-year building plan for 15 ships, there's going to be ample opportunity to see whether there's supply chain opportunities. I think the amazing thing about doing a 15-ship build over that amount of time is that the first ship will not look like the last ship.
Right.
It will physically.
But the efficiency,
software,
the technology. Every day there'll be different software.
Yeah, like the Halifax-class frigates, which are the current 12-ship backbone of the Royal Canadian Navy. You know, Irving Shipbuilding St. John towards the end could pump those out like one every 18 months. Like they were, once they, like you talk about,
the rhythm.
Supply chains are nailed down,
efficiency
of the workforce, like they just could drive through them, right? And so that's pretty exciting, but that'll be years down the road. But
right.
I think it's those opportunities you need to look at. You know, Georgetown Shipyard, you can correct me on this, is still owned by Irving's?
It is.
Right, so one of the provisions of the National Shipbuilding Strategy that Irving won for the combat package, they're building the combat ships, is that if you get that package, you can't bid on other packages. And that's important because there's about several billion dollars allocated to a small boats package. So that includes your tugboats, your survey ships, it could be lifeboats, small contracts that add up. But what that means is that Georgetown could not take advantage of those.
Okay. For any even subcomponent of those vessels.
Well, subcomponent, I don't know, right? That's a question to get into. But in terms of like that yard building those small boats, it could not.
So
right?
For Irving, it could not.
If Irving could not.
Somebody else could operate out of that facility
yes.
potentially contribute.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that Georgetown potentially could be part of a supply chain for the existing shipbuilding contracts that Halifax. That Irving's in Halifax.
Year-round ice-free port is a great, great piece of infrastructure. What about are there setbacks for different provinces? Like, is there an allocation that PEI should be some benefactor?
Not anymore.
Okay.
They move the big. So there's an offsets program, now known as ITBs. Before there was industrial regional benefits, and then
okay.
they became technological benefits.
Okay.
And that was based on a series of reviews where with the federal government consulted with business and found out, you know, the challenge with IRBs, the previous programs, that you would, you know, so much money would go to, say, a company in province X. Then once the contract was over, the company either went away or they shifted business somewhere else. So you weren't taking advantage of the investment in public money you were making into this advanced technology.
Right.
ITBs is an opportunity. I still think it's a little too early to tell because they were only rolled out in 2014. But it's an opportunity to say, okay, what are key industrial capabilities that we have in Canada? One is like training software for planes. So CAE is one of the world's largest providers of training software for pilots, naval, including the military and civilian. So that's a key capability for Canada. So what can, if we gave a major a procurement contract to a company, how could they ensure that the money that went to that contract will also be directed to help this industrial capability? So that we can strengthen that company's position, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or companies, plural, because CAE would have supply chain as well.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where the direction was taken. And it follows a number of kind of, I believe Australia and the UK also switched over from simply, you know, just allocating money across regions to actually looking at what are our key assets and how can you strengthen them competitively.
So there you go, Sam. That's something we got 30-year horizon, right. At least, yeah. Maybe 50.
If I live that long.
You just got to figure out
and
how
people,
to position.
People try to tell us policy's boring, but no. I think most people probably couldn't define policy, let alone what the capabilities you have in your background in research. Like it's very interesting. I'm glad you were able to come and tell us more about
happy to be
your
here.
Background. Yeah.
And you're a real person. You're not locked in a closet somewhere.
That's right.
They let you out at night.
That's right, they do.
Any thoughts on that supply chain? Maybe
I think I'd need a couple days on this.
I'm trying to get my head around that.
Maybe do some more research. But I guess before we kind of end up, so you've been on PEI for how many years?
It'll be six in April.
I guess some people might want to know is like, what's your favorite part about PEI? More like a personal touch versus the defense research.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm from Newfoundland, small town Newfoundland, and I miss the familiarity and the sense of the wider sense of community belonging from somewhere. And when Jenny and I, my wife, were looking at where to go, we found PEI would be a place to be like that. So, but from that, what I love about this place is that we have the same constitutional powers as Ontario and Quebec,
right.
But we're our own province and we have our own identity. And I never forget that when I go into trade negotiation meetings that we have our own interests. And it's very easy to let the big dogs eat first and boss you around. Mm-hmm. But it's really exciting and adrenaline rush to like represent this province domestically and internationally and you essentially fight for its interests. I really enjoy it. And I really love the sense of community that exists here. I live in Mount Herbert now, mm-hmm. and we're expecting our first child in July. And so, like, thanks. And so, like, our kid's going to be an Islander, which is really cool.
Cool.
And our, you know, we're going to have a growing family, and this is our home. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. It's pretty cool when you, like, you hear people that come from away, but they now you would identify as an Islander because you live here, and you want to spend the rest of your life here.
I do.
And you want to see the government progress, and you want to advance PEI's interests on the domestic and international stage.
Absolutely.
And it's pretty cool to see that, because we only really met this when I was in the Premier's office. We met at a couple different things, but just to kind of be able to see where you go and where I go, because we have that small-mindedness. Like I know what you do most times, and you'll be able to see on wherever. What is Sam doing today, or what's Jeff doing today? And I guess the same as Blake, but
I haven't been in the Premier's office, so I don't know what it looks like, but
he's our number of vintage anyways. I think it's pretty cool that it's cool to see where you start somewhere and you get to see where they go. Like if we were in Ontario, you could be 4 hours away and I would never hear from
never.
You. Now we're in different paths, but we still kind of have that connectivity to
it allows when things line up, you can get a lot of stuff done here. Like I can't give too much specifics, but I know what goes on in other provinces where they're just so vast, not just in population, but in terms of their business community and their government. The province of Ontario is about 300,000 bureaucrats. Like their entire divisions that are on phone calls when it's just me, and I can respond faster to some issues.
Like our business environment should be. We should be able to respond.
I can walk down the hall. If there's any interest, like if an island company is caught up in some trade issue, they can call me. And I can call contacts in Global Affairs Iowa and we can sort this out. Hmm. There's no massive layers of approval that I need to go through for me to help a business.
And as a sovereign state, you do feel you've got the ability to negotiate in parallel with some of these other monsters.
Yeah.
And do we need a defense force?
We need a space force.
That is great. I think Trump would definitely. How much money do we have to contribute? Because he does want to see contributions. So
he wants to go to Mars. He's pretty clear about that.
Probably people want him to go to Mars.
Blake will be on the first flight. He'll be his co-pilot.
I think is it 2050?
He'll go to the moon, right?
We might get there. I think 2050. There's a million people a year going to Mars. Musk hits his target, so he hasn't missed them yet. Short sellers don't kind of quite agree with them. Anything else, Sam,
I think we touched on a lot about your background, and I think people will be interested to hear more. And
we'll
link your contact info if they have any more questions.
Sure, they absolutely can.
Catch them on
LinkedIn, Twitter.
I think that's a good place to end, and we'll definitely have you back on at some point down the road.
So Jeff Collins, he's a trade policy
advisor.
He's a PhD. He's a professor at EPI. He's a Soon expecting
to be
father.
Soon to be father.
That's the biggest job ever.
No, it's great to have you on. You've got a lot of perspective, and I'm sure many people don't know how much work goes on behind the scenes to ensure their economy means.
And they're structured, our economy is structured properly.
Yeah. Competitively, and we're negotiating appropriately, and
absolutely.
It opens up opportunities for business that people just aren't aware of. So,
yep, absolutely.
Thanks for coming by and
no
sharing
problem.
Your perspectives.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
So there you have it, our interview with Jeff Collins, trade and policy advisor with the province of PEI, UPEI professor too, and a list of other things he's done in his short time in a professional life. What did you have any closing thoughts on that, Blake?
No, great conversation. I mean, this is the type of leadership that we have at the province that most people wouldn't really know is sort of native in our provincial government organization. And we're lucky to have people like Jeff. So, you know, if you listen to the podcast and you know other people that you think could contribute to the social dialogue of the province, let Sam or I know. And no, it's a pleasure to have have Jeff in. We've got a few recorded that have been sort of suspended for a bit, and we're looking forward to releasing those over the coming days.
Yeah, and we have actually a pretty special guest tomorrow that will be released. We won't give away too much, but it was hard to nab this guy.
It was. We had to, it's like making cheese. It takes time to get some of these good people. And we've got a few lined up.
Right on. So I guess that's probably a good place to end for today. And we'll be back tomorrow. This has been The Exchange presented by Confederation Group. I'm Sam McPhail. And with me was my co-host, Blake Doyle. Any last words, Blake?
No, just stay safe. If people can support stimulating the economy, find a way to support your local retailers. Let's try to get this thing kickstarted because it's going to take a collective effort. So that's it. Enjoy your day.
We'll see you tomorrow.